Welcome everybody. It's nice to be here with all of you. I am the CEO of Community Health Partners. I'm going to pass around our annual report. We have a number of sites in the area. Community Health Partners in Livingston, Gallatin Community Clinic in Bozeman, Community Health Partners Belgrade. We also have a full-time dental clinic over here, Community Health Partners Dental on 19th Street. All of our sites are sliding fee scale access, offer excellent health care services to people who can and can't afford care at other establishments in town. I first became familiar with Dr. Bezruchka through a radio show, alternative radio show. He was speaking about health and wealth. And in my line of work, Community Health Partners, we treat 8,000 patients a year for a total of 30,000 visits. Many of those people suffer the ill effects of poverty. And in what we do, offering medical care every day, we're challenged to reverse the effects of society. We realized we couldn't create health on our own and that there were a lot of things going on outside our walls before people ever arrived at Community Health Partners that were beyond our control. So the message that you'll hear from Dr. Bezruchka tonight pertains to the Health Olympics, looks at how we're doing as a country in the context of the world, and look forward to hearing from him. This is the fifth time I've heard him on his visit. Every time it's different, so I'm sure you'll enjoy yourself. I'm just going to pass these around.
Well, thank you very much, Lori and Adele and the other Lori for inviting me here, and thank you all for coming out tonight. It's what I hope to do is talk for about 20 minutes, I guess, about the Health Olympics. We're having an Olympic event in Beijing this year, and so we want to know how well we're going to do in this event. And what I'm going to do, everything I say is backed up, since this is the Café Scientifique. Everything I say is backed up by numerous studies, and so I hope after the presentation, after my little talk, we can get into those studies and into the research that informs this. What I want you to ask tonight is, do you want health or health care? And as a doctor who's been practicing for over 30 years, for most of my life I thought it was health care that produced health. And I've had to question that understanding because of all the things that I've learned in the last 20 years or so. I want to begin with a story. Not far from here, there was a little known isolated town situated on the top of a cliff, a beautiful spot overlooking the water. This town was blessed with a fine natural hot spring. People lived there happily. They knew the spring had remarkable benefits, and the local people used it and enjoyed good health. Other people came to the town from all around to enjoy the springs. Now, the town was set right on the edge of a high clifftop, and visitors drove to the town via the one road that came to the edge of the precipitous cliff and then turned left to go into the town. Sometimes a driver would not see the edge, and the car would plunge over the cliff, wreaking havoc to the occupants down below. In recent years, the wrecks became more common, and the town was concerned. They feared that if they didn't do something, they might lose the livelihood that that came from the people coming to enjoy the springs. So, desperate, they assembled a committee to look into the matter and hired consultants, the best in the United States, to advise them. The consultants reviewed the situation, they wrote their recommendations, and then the committee reached the decision, which they announced at a town meeting. You all know what the decision was, but I'll go ahead and announce it anyway. The head of the committee reviewed the problem of the road coming to the edge of the cliff so that an occasional guest car would plunge down to the bottom. The consultants had found the ideal solution. The town would build a state-of-the-art hospital and trauma center at the bottom of the cliff. Obviously, the right answer. Well, what this suggests, of course, is that the United States' response to issues of health is namely more health care. But we already spend half of the world's health care bill. $2.2 trillion was spent in 2006, which represents one-sixth of our total economy in this country. And So we should ask, what are we getting for this expenditure? Well, what I hope to get you to see is that it doesn't buy us anything remotely resembling health. There's no expert who would disagree with the statement that the relationship between healthcare services and being healthy is very limited at best. You won't find any expert who would disagree with that statement. I would hope to get you grappling with this concept even more, because I think most of you would consider that it is healthcare that buys us health. So why wouldn't it? Well, another analogy looks at the Army Medical Corps and consider what that Army Medical Corps has to do with the battle. Medical care is sort of like the Army Medical Corps. It doesn't decide whether we go to war or not. It doesn't decide whether we invade from the air or send in ground troops or plant landmines or any other battle strategy. That's all decided by someone else. All the Army Medical Corps does is go in after the blast or the bomb or the shrapnel's embedded or the gunfire is over and look for those with signs of life. If they find someone who's not obviously dead, they will splint the mangled limb, try to stem the bleeding, start an IV, and evacuate the victim to a field hospital. There they'll do the so-called golden hour of trauma care and hope that they're able to transport the casualty to definitive care where the bleeding sources are stopped and contaminated loops of bowel are dealt with. Eventually, if the person survives, they'll end up in a tertiary care hospital where prosthetic limbs are fitted and rehabilitation plans are made. Now, most of the casualties of the battle actually die in the first few minutes after the blast or the shots are fired. The Army Medical Corps can't do anything about that. All they can try and do is keep the victims alive, and the subsequent medical services work on their results. They can't do any more than that. If the Army Medical Corps could decide on whether to invade or not, or what the battle strategies were, or the ordnance, or the tactical steps would be, then the Army Medical Corps could have a huge impact on mortality. But medical care is like the Army Medical Corps. Namely, the key factors impacting health are not in its purview. So, what about health? What is it? What produces it? I spend a great deal of time with international students and also speak in other countries about these ideas. And outside of this country, if I ask for a definition of health, I get the same answer almost everywhere. Health is a state of complete mental, physical, and social well-being, and not merely the absence of disease. It's the World Health Organization definition that was produced in 1947. Health is a state of complete mental and physical well-being and social well-being, and not merely the absence of disease. How do you measure that? Well, it's really tough for an individual. It's very hard as a concept to operationalize, but for an individual, just asking them how healthy they are on a scale of 1 to 5 turns out to be a pretty good measure of someone's health when you aggregate it for a whole population. In other words, if you take a sample of a population and ask them how healthy they are on a scale of 1 to 5, and then you record those and then you compare it with mortality rates, you find that where more people rank their health as being better, mortality rates are lower. People seem to know. So, what's the take-home message now? Anytime somebody asks you how healthy you are, you say, extremely healthy. Okay. Well, the WHO definition talks about health as not being merely the absence of disease. And that's really important because now, as working as a doctor with all the sophisticated tests, I can find disease in anybody if I just do enough tests. Isn't that right? If any of you in this room think you're healthy, you haven't had enough tests yet. So, have I done somebody a favor by doing some tests and saying, well, this value is a little off and there's a little spot on this x-ray? Have I helped the person? I think we need to do some more tests. We need to refer you to some more consultants. No, I haven't helped the person by that information. I've made them worry. And as a doctor, my job is often to do that, to sort of cover my behind and make sure that I don't miss anything. Well, the other, so we're in a situation where we need to look at other measures for health of a society or population, and the easiest ones that you can use to make comparable statements are measures of mortality. I work as an ER doc, and as an ER doc, I can usually tell whether someone's alive or dead. Okay, and so in rich countries, we all measure when someone's born and when they die, and that allows us to calculate mortality rates. And mortality rates that are useful for comparisons include the proportion of infants that die in their first year of life, or the average length of life that a population lives. Now, it's interesting that the CIA keeps track of all of these data, and if you go to our Central Intelligence Agency's World Rankings part of the website, and you put in life expectancy, you'll find that we rank 45th. If you put into infant mortality, we do about something similar to that. But since we've all survived infancy, let me focus on life expectancy. Born today, at today's mortality rates, how long can you expect to live if the death rate stayed the same? Measures the average years of life. Now, many of you might say, I don't really want to live a long life. I want to live a happy life. That's what I'm after. I don't want to spend my old years being decrepit. Well, anything that I say tonight about mortality rates, about life expectancy, are also true for measures such as healthy life expectancy or disability-adjusted life expectancy that take into account these other measures of well-being. But I'm just going to focus on mortality measures, but unfortunately the same thing is true for these happy or healthy or disability-adjusted measures. So armed with a definition of health and a way to calculate these health measures, it makes sense to ask, what's a normal life expectancy or a normal infant mortality? Much the same way that when you measure your cholesterol, we have a sense of what normal is or what a normal blood pressure is. We always ask what's normal. That makes good sense. So notice that a cholesterol or a blood pressure is a measure for an individual. We don't ask for a family cholesterol level or a family blood pressure, though it might be interesting to consider. A life expectancy is a measure for a society, a population, a country. So what might a normal life expectancy be or a normal infant mortality? Well, I would offer that normal would be the best, the standard of the best in the world, would be a normal life expectancy. Now, it was interesting. Our concepts of normal have changed over time. I don't know, maybe some people that can remember that in the 1940s, we used to think a high blood pressure was normal and really good for you. And the higher the blood pressure, the more it squeezed blood into our brains and into our muscles. And as a matter of fact, President Roosevelt had a very high blood pressure. We all talked, oh, this is wonderful. And of course, what happened to him was, he had a hemorrhagic bleed from high blood pressure and died. Then when in the 1950s and the 1960s, we began to say normal blood pressure increased with age. Some of you might remember there was a formula for how much your blood pressure was supposed to increase as you got older. We don't think of that as being normal anymore. We think everybody's blood pressure should be lower down. So our concepts of normal change. So what should the normal life expectancy be? Well, I think it should be the best possible value attainable by any country. Now, notice this year we're having the Summer Olympics in Beijing, and so what if there was an event for health? What if there was an event for infant mortality or for life expectancy? How well would we do? Well, in something like the 100-meter dash, we always do very well. And in the Olympics at large, we win the most gold medals most of the time, and we've won the most medals in the Olympics since the event started in 1922. So if the Health Olympics was a sanctioned event, how well do we do in that race? Well, the interesting thing is we wouldn't even we'd be disqualified in the trials. We wouldn't even get to the final day's event. We would have dropped out a long time ago. In other words, with 185 countries competing, and I'm using now, instead of the CIA measure, which uses tiny populations, the United Nations ranking, we're about 30th. And of course, if you're competing in a race and you're 30th in the trials, they're not going to let you there for the final event. Only the top 10 or 20 are allowed to compete. So we wouldn't be there for the final event, but we do better than about 150 countries. So maybe we should be proud of that. That is, we're healthier than Zambia or Papua New Guinea or Lesotho or Swaziland. Maybe that's good news. But if we rank 30th in the 100-meter dash, you can be sure there would be a commission to investigate why we're doing so poorly. But I don't know of any such commission that investigates why our health is not doing so well in the Health Olympics. So maybe there should be a commission established to investigate why we die so much younger than people in other rich countries and a few poor ones as well, especially given all the money we spend on health care. But there isn't any such commission, and most Americans don't realize they push up daisies so much sooner than they might if they were normal. Now, recall Lake Wobegon, where all the children were above average. Remember Garrison Keillor? We live in Lake Die Too Soon, where all the people's health is below normal. So what does it mean for the United States, the world's richest and most powerful country, who spends half of the world's health care bill to die so young? First of all, is it true? Is it true that we die younger than we should? In fact, running 30th is the best that we can do. Since, as I mentioned with the CIA, in the Special Olympics, okay, the CIA runs the Special Olympics because they have a lot of disabled countries competing, like Andorra and San Marino and Monaco. You know, these are disabled countries. And so I don't like to run the Special Olympics. I think we should just compete in the regular Olympics where we come in 30th. Now, there's no expert that would disagree that we in the United States die much younger than people in the other developed countries. That's not an issue. It just doesn't enter the public radar screen. So we are quite unhealthy, and by that statement I mean everyone. And that includes the subpopulations that you can think of. That is, there isn't a subpopulation that we can look of and say that it really is quite healthy and that we ought to be there. If we extract just our healthiest, they don't do well comparing ourselves with the totality in other countries. So if we look at our times in the Health Olympics, we run about 4.4 years lower than the healthiest countries. 4.4 years. Do you care if you spend another 4.4 years drooling in a nursing home? Is that all it represents? Well, to get a sense of that, if we eradicated our leading cause of death, heart disease, if present trends continue, it will dispatch roughly half of us in this room. If we eradicated heart disease as a cause of death, we would only gain about 3 years in the Health Olympics times. We still wouldn't be the healthiest country in the world. So what I'm suggesting is that 4.4 years separating us from the winner is a huge health disparity. Well, perhaps if we were always just less healthy, it was no big deal. Maybe we've always placed 30th, and that's just the United States. Now, it's interesting. Most of my medical school notes, I went to medical school starting at Stanford in 1970, and most of my notes I pitched. But there was one course called Medicine and Society in the first year that I kept the notes for. And I went back and reviewed the notes for the first lecture on March 31st, 1971. And there it said that in 1950, we had the lowest maternal mortality ratio of all countries. That is, we had the lowest proportion of women dying in childbirth of all countries. I then wrote below that, by 1966, 20 countries were doing better than we were in the maternal mortality Olympics. Well, that is true for most health indicators across the board. We were doing really well in the Olympics in the early 1950s, but we've continued to sort of have a slide ever since. So do we have health in the United States? Remember I asked, do you want health or health care? Well, we don't if we consider how other countries are doing. And again, there's no expert that would disagree here. We die much younger than we should if we compare ourselves to the healthier nations in the world. Now, one doesn't have to go very far to find a healthier country. If you go 300 miles north of us, you'll find that for working age mortality rates, just in Canada, they're 50% lower than they are down here. Mortality rates are, for working age populations in Canada are 50% lower than in the United States. That's huge. So we die so much quicker and they're much healthier in Canada. Now, how is it that we're unaware of this vital issue? I really consider it a problem, but I'm not sure if most Americans don't accept the fact that they die so young. Maybe we're like fish. Fish aren't aware that they live in the water because they can't live without it. Maybe we die younger because we're just not aware of this. Maybe we glorify, we feel glorified by the rapper 50 Cent. You know, his album was titled Get Rich or Die Trying. Maybe we're all dying trying. I'm going to suggest that we all die younger, including the rich, and maybe it's because we like attending funerals and eagerly await our own. I hope not. I don't want to sound too morbid. The next question to ask is why is our health as a nation so not normal? Now here there's no up to now nobody would disagree with anything I've said. When you ask why, there's no consensus among experts. But mostly the question is not asked. Mostly the question is not asked. And I'll review some possible reasons and present my own opinions, one backed up by the federal government's key advisor on health matters, the Institute of Medicine. The commonest explanation that people give for our poor health is we relate to our health behaviors. Namely, we smoke too much. We don't eat right. We don't exercise. We don't use condoms. Now, studies on the roles of behaviors in producing health are consistent in saying that no more than 10% of our health is related to the behaviors that we do or do not engage in. A striking example relates to smoking. Out of all the rich countries, we have the smallest proportion of men smoking, and the healthiest country in the world, Japan, has the highest proportion of men smoking. Namely, twice as many men smoke per capita in Japan than in the United States. These are data from the American Cancer Society's publication, Tobacco Control Country Profiles. Now, that isn't the reason that Japan is so healthy, namely that all the men smoke. But it does suggest that there are factors that affect populations that are worse for health than not smoking. Or smoking, sorry. And the other behaviors, when you look at them, produce similarly conflicting findings. The reason that we're not so healthy is not because of the health-related behaviors that we do or do not indulge in. The next explanation commonly offered is that we lack universal access to health care. But I've already pointed out the limited impact that health care can have, from the Army Medical Corps concept or the trauma center at the bottom of the cliff. Now, we have only one published study on the impact of universal health care on the health of whole populations. And that showed that it did not produce health in populations. It wasn't an important factor. Okay? Only one published study exists in the literature that I'm aware of, and I've asked the authors of that study if they're aware of any other study, and they're not. I bet there are some further negative studies that are just sitting there in filing cabinets that will never see the light of day. Now, public health textbooks, if they ask the question, does medical care produce health, if they ask the question, say there's no evidence. So they're consistent with what I say. Another reason presented is our lack of education. Now, it's easy to dismiss this because we're the country with the most average years of education of any country. We also have the most Nobel Prizes and the most intellectual achievements. So it's not because we're undereducated, although we may not be educated on what produces health. So I've talked about what doesn't matter. What does matter in producing health? A number of studies point to the importance of early life issues in our health as adults. Roughly half of our health as adults is determined by age 4 or 5. That is, as we go from the womb to the tomb, as we go from the erection to the resurrection, somewhere around age 5, roughly half of the die of our health as adults is already cast. And that's before we enter kindergarten. And probably out of those 6 years, the first half is more important than the second half. That is, conception to age 2 or so matters much more than 2 to 5. Now, the fetus is programmed in the womb, and we find that biological embedding happens after birth. And of the factors that I think are really important for our health are secure attachment after you're born to a single pair of eyes and body to nurture you. Now, without it, we suffer later in life. And consider that United States, Swaziland, Lesotho, and Papua New Guinea are the only 4 countries in the world without a paid maternity leave policy. United States, Swaziland, Lesotho, 2 little South African countries, and Papua New Guinea, half of an island north of Australia, are the only 4 countries in the world without a paid maternity leave policy. Now, why would we not want such a policy? It's interesting. I was on a radio interview actually a week ago here in town on the AM radio, and I presented this, and a listener called in and she said, you know, this stuff about paid maternity leave policy is really nonsensical. We planned to have a baby, and I worked really hard and saved up enough money so that I could stay home with the baby for a year without working. So if I can do it, other people can. That was a response from somebody in the local radio station a week ago. But of course, most people are struggling on low incomes, and there's no way that they can do that. So what do some of the healthier countries do in terms of early life policies, the ones that have normal life expectancies? Well, Sweden, for example, where people live long, healthy lives, has a mandatory years maternity, paternity leave at full pay. You can't get out of it in Sweden. If you have a baby, you have to stay home. Well, you can't work for a year. You may not have to stay home, but you can't work for a year and you collect your paycheck. If the mother takes the full year, the father has to take 12 weeks. It's really tough. Then in Sweden, if you the second year is optional. It's not mandatory, but only at 80% pay. You only get 80% pay for the second year if you stay home with your child. Then in the third year, if you want to go back to work, it's fine. You can put your child in a Swedish government-run daycare center that's free. And what are the requirements to work at a Swedish daycare center? You have to have a master's degree in play. Because what's daycare all about? It's socializing the child. And we need experts for that. Now, Sweden, this is the Swedish government that pays your salary when you're at home with your baby, and they take it out of their high tax revenues. Tax rates are very high in Sweden, and they get what they pay for. The most important factors, then, equivalent to the water that a fish doesn't recognize that are essential for its well-being, is the relatively caring and sharing nature of a society. Society where people are cared for and shared with, relatively egalitarian, is what produces health in society. And that's what the research over the last half century has demonstrated. Societies with a big gap between the rich and the poor are less healthy than societies where the differences are more moderate and people interact to support one another. Where there's a big gap, those who have too much say to those lower down, look, I can pay for what I need, and I get good quality services with my money, and I can consume good products, so I don't want to spend my money for others to have that. They can buy it themselves. So we've cut welfare as we know it. Remember back in 1966. And we've cut support for low-cost housing and have homeless on the streets. That was done in 1981. We've cut funding for mental health services and for schools. Of course, if the rich send their children to private schools, why should they support the public system? So the thing that's been most measured in the research is the income gap, and that's really a proxy for how a society looks out for those within it. And the body I mentioned, the Institute of Medicine, the think tank, the federally funded think tanks, writes on page 59 of its 2003 report, The Future of the Public's Health in the 21st Century, they write, more egalitarian societies, i.e. those with a less deep differential between the richest and the poorest, have better average health. More egalitarian societies have better average health. Isn't that what I've been saying? As you know, inequality in this country has soared. And today we transfer about $1 trillion every year from the rest of us to the rich in the form of tax cuts and subsidies and deferring royalty payments and all sorts of ways that we didn't have 50 years ago. And that was back when we were one of the healthiest countries in the world. The reasons why we do this now stem from what was happening in the 1950s and 60s when the richest 1% in this country saw their wealth decline from close to half in the early part of the century down to a quarter. The richest 1% only had a quarter of the wealth by 1973. And they didn't like that. So they crafted a series of ways of making sure that they got back to having close to half of all the wealth, which is where they are now. And so we're quite happy transferring that $1 trillion. But I pointed out that perhaps we're all dying younger because of that, and the rich are also dying younger too. There was a study published in the Journal of the American Medical Association 2 years ago pointing out that rich Americans are less healthy than poor Brits. And that's true for other countries as well. So because we have this big gap between the rich and the poor in our society, it's actually murder. It's the perfect crime. And since the rich are perpetrating this and dying younger too, it's murder-suicide. And I think it's the most senseless crime possible. Since everyone's worse off, it's a lose-lose situation. So do you want health or health care? Ideally, we want both, but it appears we don't have either. But that can change. What we have to do is stop transferring the $1 trillion every year, and we could begin by having a paid maternity-paternity leave policy like all the other countries, and then we would not be in the league with Swaziland, Lesotho, and Papua New Guinea. And I think we deserve that. But first, we fish need to become aware of the water around us. As fish, we've got to swim against the current that is washing us downstream to our deaths. Otherwise, even dead fish go with the flow downstream. And it won't take us that much effort at all. So I hope in the discussion we might strategize on some of the steps that we might take. And let me end on this by reciting two poems. The first is from the era of my youth, by Lawrence Ferling Getty, called Pity the Nation. Pity the nation whose people are sheep and whose shepherds mislead them. Pity the nations whose leaders are liars, whose sages are silenced, and whose bigots haunt the airwaves. Pity the nation that raises not its voice except to praise conquerors and acclaim the bully.